Welcome to Interviews About Change, Episode 4. In this episode, I interviewed Art Rosengarten, where we discuss Carl Jung, Art's Tarot of the Nine Paths, and all sorts of stuff about the symbolism of change and how we get ourselves unstuck and interpret the symbols that come towards us. If you have not heard the rest of the episodes, you can find them on my blog, thehermitslamp.com, and just click the tarot blog button, or you can search The Hermit's Lamp or Andrew McGregor in iTunes, and you can subscribe to the audio portions of my blog that way.
I'm Dr. Art Rosengarten. I'm a Jungian psychologist. I've been in private practice for over 30 years. I wrote the first doctoral dissertation on the tarot, where I compared tarot readings to dream work and projective storytelling back in the mid-80s, where I studied in graduate school in San Francisco at the California Institute of Integral Studies, where I really spent a lot of time developing my ideas and thoughts about tarot cards and divination and tarot symbols as a graduate student. And I've written a few things. My book, Tarot and Psychology, Spectrums of Possibility, has been in print for 10 years now. It recently was translated into Korean, and I got to tell you, it's just really wild to see a book in Korean symbols and signs. It's quite fascinating. I have no idea if they did a good job or not. There's no way of interpreting it. Mm-hmm. But also, I have taught the tarot throughout California. I'm in Southern California in San Diego County in a town called Encinitas. But I have taught the tarot in India and also on a small trip to Egypt many years ago. Also, most recently, I produced and created, designed my own deck called Tarot of the Nine Paths, which I presented at the World Tarot Congress, the second one, and the third one, actually. And that's a little bit about me. Now, I teach the tarot and I try to include and integrate this kind of work into talk therapy with mostly teenagers and adults and groups. I should also add that there's a third leaf in my theoretical and philosophical background, and that is I'm also a Buddhist practitioner. And I really kind of come to tarot not so much from the Western occult tradition as the Eastern Zen / Tibetan Buddhist flavor. And so that also informs my view. That's about it for me on that.
So what are some of the symbols that show up for people in their dreams that might also have a relationship to the tarot that you see as symbols of people getting stuck, where they're getting caught up in something, and even if they know it, they're stuck in a way that might be hard for them to release that or to move through it?
Right. I get the question. Now, I would say that, any tarot card has that kind of issue in it. I would say that all tarot cards have different levels regarding change. They're all, on the first level, they're all changing into their opposites. They're all moving towards or running against their opposite side, what Jung called enantiodromia, an old Greek word meaning that things naturally tend to move into their opposites. So, if in every tarot card, whether you use reversals or not, there is a tendency in that symbol for it to tend to move to its opposite state. That's natural and normal. getting stuck could indicate that a person is resisting a natural tendency towards, opposition or moving to its shadow side. That's one level I would say.
And when you say opposition, can you give me an example? Like pick a card and say, the Two of Cups is sort of this way and its opposite would be, whatever
well,
you see.
Now, the Two of Cups say if you hold it upside down or reverse it, there is an emphasis on its opposite energy, which is a part of itself. It's, because I think things are composed of polarities and opposites. So say the Two of Cups, which may signify, two being a number of relatedness, cups, containers of emotion, the two of cups could, signify, a relationship that contains, loving feelings, and obviously as it seems. Now, if we reversed it, it could suggest either that there's difficulty in holding that particular constellation, or there's that energy is not going outward, but is tending to go inward, like the inner Two of Cups. Those are two levels of reversal that talk about the energetics within the card. Some tarot cards, by their nature, energetically are predisposed to go outward. Mostly the wands, the fire cards, tend to have more difficulty when they're bottled up, and there's a resistance in that kind of fire energy when they're reversed, it tends to bunch you up emotionally and lend itself to frustration or misplaced anger or explosion or burnout. Other cards, by their nature, at least in my opinion, are more naturally suited for the inner realms, even if they're not reversed. Say the cups, in fact. If the Queen of Cups, for instance, which has to do with, say, a loving, nurturing, mothering energy, if that was reversed, that might just indicate, bringing that, presence to oneself, which is more natural. That's one level that I answer your question, but when you're talking about the tarot and change, there's a beautiful sentence that was written by a great tarot writer, Cynthia Giles. I don't know if you're familiar with her work.
I am.
The tarot, history, mystery, and lore. And I agree with this, and I think it's really in keeping with what we're witnessing now. And what Cynthia says is, magical philosophy blossoms when old structures of cultural certainty start to crumble, much the way flowering vines will immediately insinuate themselves into the cracking walls of an abandoned building. It's a beautiful image of these flowering vines kind of working their way through kind of a broken old system. And I think that in our day, we certainly can see a lot of broken old systems that are going through change, and worldwide, mm-hmm. old structures. And there's not really there's a process taking place. And in the cracks, so to speak, in popular and Western culture and Eastern cultures, I think, this is a very opportune moment for what we could call magical philosophy to kind of insinuate itself into the vacuum here. I think that has a lot to do with tarot and change in our time.
I like that. I love that quote. It's great. And I think that you're right. I certainly see, how many decks are being created? How many new or shifting approaches are we seeing popping up here and there? I think it's a real exploration time with tarot and with other systems as well, which I think is fantastic. When it comes back to an individual, though, do you, so because you do a bunch of different things on different levels with people, and although they might all come from the same source, I would imagine that they have their different manifestations between your counseling work and your doing a tarot reading and what might come out of your Buddhist practice. And when you see somebody who's caught in the same pattern, and this is something I've been talking about with everybody, where they're sort of at the precipice of change but are unable to take that step forward for some reason, how would you help them? What do you think you could do, or advice might you have to people who are looking at that kind of change and unable to step through that doorway?
What I, you know, of course, it would depend on the level of awareness or intellect that particular client had. But I try to ground someone in the understanding that ultimately there is no change or stagnation, that ultimately things are the way they are now, and there's nowhere to go, nothing to do, no one to be. There's a basic sense of just presence and awareness that is really who we are. And if in a short meditative moment, we may first kind of tap into, you know, that whole power of now, momentary experience, we could have a sense that we're okay just the way we are, and that this identified change or this challenge isn't indispensable. It's more or less a choice. And that it's a choice of a direction, but it's not indispensable. It's not required because we're already okay just the way we are. Now, that's one, definitely with many of my clients, that's the kind of grounding that I work with in the here and now, so that the whole journey part of which the tarot is about, the whole thing about we're on a path and we're going from A to Z, and this is a part of the path, that is given a context where it begins where we've already arrived. There's nowhere to go. So it takes a lot of the onus, a lot of the pressure out of that moment when we're trying to make, quote, progress.
It seems like a strongly influenced difference between the Western mindset and a more Eastern mindset, from what I'm hearing too, where we're always looking about where we're going, how much money do we have in the bank, how quickly can we get there, as opposed to maybe more influenced by your Buddhist practice and that worldview as well.
No question. Well, you know, I've coined a term, and I've described myself over the years as a Tabugian psychologist. That's tarot-based Buddhist Jungian. Tabugian, and there is what I call the intermediate territory, and I call that's where the Jungian psychology really, and you know, the Western magical traditions really are alive, which they're talking about the archetypal realm, the dream realm, where symbols, archetypes really do have this relative existence. And that's what we do with divination. We go into this intermediate realm, like a waking dream, and we confront these energies, these symbols, but we don't take them too literally, and we don't necessarily believe that, you know, the fool's journey as such is a real thing, and it's a real destination that exists in ordinary conditioned reality. It's more a metaphorical world, symbolic world that we utilize in our journey to timelessness, which is not the same as it's the unconditioned mind is really the goal. And this intermediate territory that tarot cards are all about is a vehicle, one of a number of vehicles that help us work at that phase of it, but we have to renounce it or abandon it as well when, to finally attain arrival to being here, where we realized there was no place to go at all. So it's one of those things, you know, in the East they call that useful poison. Useful in that it gives us a template or a map to navigate through this intermediate territory. But poison, if we, you know, we reify it or believe it or create it as if it actually existed or solidified these symbols, like they actually were talking about a real thing, because we would miss the real purpose.
I think that the confusion of levels, which is what I would refer to some of that as, you know, the sort of spiritually useful but not literally true, and you know, what's helpful from astrology and what about people's views of astrology binds them to it, where they start to define themselves by, well, I have this and that, therefore I'm always going to be that way. I think that, you know, those things are very similar, and I really love the idea of sort of abandoning it. It's kind of like going on a car ride where, you know, you still need to get out of the car at the end of it, and you're actually coming back to your own home, a little different from the journey.
That's right. mountains are mountains and valleys are valleys in the last stage, you know. And that's right. And so because of this perspective, or with this perspective, if anything, tarot work, oracle work, is, to my mind, is even more exciting and more interesting, because it really gives us a beautiful tool to develop spiritually through that intermediate territory, you know, as a self tool, as a meditative tool. Also, then there's the absolute wonder of divination, of reading tarot cards, that also is an art form that occurs in that intermediate region. And it basically is a direct invitation to synchronicity and a causality, where, you know, 100% of the time, really, when you are in the divination mode, there is meaning, or there is relevance going on in the transmission that is brought about by these tarot cards and the actual oracle process itself. And so that's a whole nother part. That's, you know, divination and oracles are extremely, extremely helpful on the spiritual path.
And one of the things I always find fascinating about readings is how, when I read for people, some of the time I'll say something to them and I will have no understanding of the context or profoundness of what's being said.
Right.
But it will go to them, and, you know, it's almost as if their subconscious, my subconscious, our spiritual selves are arranging it so that they can hear the wording that they need to hear to receive a message, whereas I'm not even necessarily processing it at that level, because
it's the
mystery of the reading.
Absolutely. That mystery of the reading. It's not, we're just conduits. It happens through us. We're just, you know, mindless messengers, and it's the tarot gods that are communicating. What you say reminds me of what I teach as the, you know, three key things that oracles really do. One is they translate a problem or question into an image language, like that of dreams. And all of a sudden we kind of become initiated into the symbolic dimension. Two, they mirror the unconscious forces shaping any given moment, problem, or situation. They really widen our consciousness. So no longer are we on that narrow personal trajectory, but we're now opening up to the whole contextual dimension of our existence, the transpersonal, the background noise, the, you know, the subtlety, these unconscious, that, so they tarot cards pick up all of that stuff, where our narrow focal ego awareness is very limited, very, you know, focused. And then the third thing that oracles really do is they, you could say from a psychological standpoint, they capitalize on a key psychological insight, namely that in every symptom, conflict, or problem, there is an inner spirit trying to communicate with us. This is really what Freud was all about. That it's a way of reframing conflicts and problems and symptoms is actually tremendous opportunities to listen in on that spirit dimension.
When you're saying that, the spirit there, are you referring to the idea that the negative situation we might choose is teaches us about what we really need, or those kinds of things? Or are you referring to a more direct or overtly spiritual level?
Well, I don't really make a distinction between the two, really.
Okay.
I would say that both of what you said are accurate. I don't know, when we talk about a, quote, spiritual dimension, I'm not exactly sure what that is.
Well, I mean, I guess what I would, you know, people who are people of faith, people of, you know, who believe in, objectively in, say, angels and external spiritual beings and things like that. Perhaps that's just outside of the way in which you view things.
Right. Well, you see, that for me, that's all about belief.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fairly intellectual or cognitive experience that is where there's an idea that's being perpetuated or reinforced or re-experienced, etc. And so I don't necessarily agree that that's what this all that is in the spiritual dimension. There's also non-belief in the spiritual dimension, and there could be no belief per se, and we can presence or access, you know, I hate to say the word energetically, but I think that communicates something that is expansive, perhaps blissful, perhaps sympathetic, with no belief at all in angels or gods and demons and any of that. It's not really required for the experience.
I wanted to go back to when we were talking about the power of oracles. I was talking with, in my last interview I put up with Rachel Pollack, about the Oedipus myth, and she has been exploring the idea that it was actually the oracle that brought about all the troubles that come from that. I'm wondering if you have any ideas on that.
No, I'd love to hear what Rachel has to say on that one. It sounds very interesting. I'd rather leave that one to her. I have not really spent a lot of time with that myth lately, so that's great. That's a great idea. Yeah.
Well, I will. I'll make sure you get the link. You can go and listen to it.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. You've created your own deck, and I wonder both. Well, firstly, I guess, how was that process for you? And did you find that was a changing process? Did it affect you as you were doing it?
100%. And it really was a kind of personal journey, you could say. You know, I created it in my wine cellar over several years, hunched over a sandbox in a kind of a moldy old wine cellar with thousands of miniature objects, intuitively trying to create scenes in a sandbox using a technique called Jungian sand play, never had done it, has been done before like that, to be my artistic medium in creating TNP or Tarot of the Nine Paths, because I'm not really a formally trained artist. My motivation for the deck was really an insight and a discovery I've had for after my book, I wrote my book in the late 90s, of the obvious incompletion of the major arcana of modern tarot, and an idea of how that problem and that riddle could be solved, expanding the majors to by five cards to create a real symmetry in the classic canon, based on a numerology and a certain thread that runs through the deck that seemed obvious to me. And so that was why I did it. I actually presented my theory at the Second World Tarot Congress in Chicago. Before I had even had the deck, I demonstrated it with like a weight deck. But I knew that to really be persuasive, I had to have my own deck to actually show what I'm talking about. So I went about, and it took me about 3 years to create it. But it's really about the major arcana and about what I call the magical properties of number nine and the hermit effect. So, yeah, it was and still is a very creative and personal journey for me.
And so what are the five missing cards? I mean, if it's possible for you to give sort of a brief answer to that.
Basically, I can tell you the placement of where they belong and the names and archetypes I've given them inferentially based on what's gone before, what seems to me to make the most sense in terms of the map itself. These are not so much my inventions, but more going into the deck itself and see what the deck has to communicate about itself from its own side, and it kind of just naturally unfolded. If you look at three rows of nine, you know, magician to hermit, wheel of fortune to sun, and then you go the third row, you start at the world card, and it ends prematurely, you know, with the world. With the judgment card, and it ends prematurely with the world card, and then we tend to throw the fool after that. If you've studied tarot constellations with Angelus Arian or Mary Greer, that third row has always been has always bothered me, because when you look at, say, soul and personality cards through constellations, there's a lot of soft explanations for why there's no further cards on that third row, and you know, with the 22 trumps. For me, it was real clear there should be 27 trumps, three rows of nine, so we could see nine clear paths and look at the the nine triads or dialects that really express the true teachings of the tarot. So that this deck is called Tarot of the Nine Paths, TNP. Now those five cards, as I've dubbed them, with each card has a number, a name, and then a principle. So the first new card is Trump 22, that comes after the world, and that I call the Well, and it's an agent of renewal. That marks the kind of recycling of the new renaissance of tarot. And then there would be Trump 23, which I call the river, and that is an agent of flow. Then 24, the ring, universal archetype, like all of these principles could not be redundant in the major arcana, and they had to have universality and archetypicality, as well as have a complete synthesis of the two cards that are directly beneath it in its particular line. So, like the first row, we all know Magician, Wheel of Fortune, Sun, and that first path, that's already been... There's a relationship between that first card and the last card with the Wheel of Fortune in the middle. So it's three tiers. So just continuing across, I hope I'm not confusing you. After the ring, 24, then there'd be 25, which I call the dragon, which is an agent of initiation. And then Trump 26, which I call the Great Web, which is an agent of interbeing or interdependency. And finally, I push the Fool card down to the final card where it belongs. It's the 27 or the zero, which is, becomes a perfect third level of the nine. So, you know, the 2 plus 7 is a nine. So that really completes the whole mandala of the major arcana. So it changes some of the constellations, but basically works with the ordering principle as it's been established since the Marseilles in the 17th century.
That's great. I will make sure I put up an illustration of this on the blog so that people can look at it and follow along as we're talking about it.
You've probably seen it on my website.
Yep.
I have a dedicated website for this particular deck, and Tarot of the Nine Paths, published by Paragon House, and can be ordered. And in fact, I'm going to be presenting a paper at the, of all places, the American Culture Association / Popular Cultural Association annual conference in San Antonio. With Emily Auger and a number of handful of tarot scholars, and where tarot fits in this kind of conversation about American culture, I have no idea. But because my tarot thing is very funky, in that I use sand clay miniatures, which are like ordinary iconic symbols costing $5 or less that I have all in my own house. Mm-hmm. As these archetypal objects to illustrate this matrix, I guess that puts it as somewhat of a cultural expression, cultural deck.
It's got a little touch of Andy Warhol to it or something.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And how do you integrate the sand play and the reading when you work with people, or are they kind of separate things you might do?
That's an interesting question. In my tarot classes, for instance, I certainly do exercises where, you know, see, sand play is like three-dimensional tarot. So, you know, I'm looking at my shelves right now as I speak to you next to my little sandbox in the corner. So I use sand play oracularly. When I'm working with people with, you know, in a Jungian divination process, I might have them, you know, after cards, I might have them go select objects and put it on top of the cards that they selected face down, say, in a spread. And then in the reading, I might have them turn over the card and amplify it through the object that they synchronistically had selected right next to it. It just adds another dimension to the symbol interpretation. And I don't do that all the time, of course, but there, the two, you know, in my book, Tarot and Psychology, I talk a little bit about tarot and sand play. I am a trained sand play therapist as well, and how, what a natural tandem the two offer therapists. And yeah, I get so many people that are therapists or expressive arts therapists or marriage counselors or creative people that just love these tools. And a lot of my students are all PhDs and MFTs and art therapists that, that love the way this stuff works in their own practice with people. It really brings a lot of life and power to regular counseling situations for people. It's terrific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love using the cards to help people, speaking of, you know, to go back to being stuck, mm-hmm. when people are unsure about what they're feeling or whatever, you know, to have them pull out a card and use that as a mirror to start accessing through the synchronicity of the card, through their reaction to the symbols that are present, to access that stuckness.
That's you know, there's so many uses. It's basically it brings back the creativity of the worker to just see what's going on in the moment and see how the tarot symbol might be used in a variety of ways, and it's unlimited. It's really excellent.
Yeah, it's definitely something I find more and more is there are no limits on how one can work with the cards.
No limits, know? Exactly. You know, one of the things that I've often said is that the cards with one or two conditions, preconditions, and I'll tell you what those are. The readings are always accurate, 100% of the time accurate. However, first I'll tell you the preconditions. With the precondition that a person is sincere, is participating in the process sincerely, that's basically the precondition. That's it. The reading is 100% accurate. However, accurate is not really accurate. The right word is relevant. That 100% of the time, a reading will be relevant to what's going on in the querent at this time. And if really the subject, the querent, is not getting that, really not getting it, or getting or kind of vaguely getting it, the onus, the burden is really on the reader. It's not that the tarot has let us down. You assume unconditionally, this is what I call the prime directive of tarot reading, is the card is always right. Always. So now the burden comes on the reader. The reader needs to break out of his own limitation of interpretation, his own maybe unconscious bias, to move to where there is relevance in this interpretation, in this question. And I think that with a reader with, you know, reasonable skill, that's easily done.
Mm-hmm. I find that reflected in my practice a lot, where I will say something and the person won't quite integrate it, or they'll be like, I don't know about that. And I'll go back and deconstruct the language I use and try and reword it, not necessarily even change it, because, you know, that might be how the message reflects to me, but reword it within the kind of language I'm picking up from them and the kind of way in which they present themselves, and with my intuition too, to change the way I deliver the message so that they get it, so that they resonate with it more.
That's what this whole art form is teaching us, all about that very skillful way of deepening communication.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am very curious, because I'm not really familiar with your deck. I've looked at stuff online, but I don't actually have it yet. But I'm very curious about the well card. I've been starting this process over the last few months of designing my own deck. And over the last week or so, I've been working on the lover's card. And in every drawing that I pull out, there is a well in that card. So I'm curious what the well card symbolizes in your work, in your deck.
It's a great card. It's the well symbolizes, I think, the next phase that we are harbingers of in the unfolding of the tarot. Actually, it's the new Renaissance. But right in front of me, I have a list of associations that I. For this particular card, that's right in my little lexicon here, and I could read a little bit of that to you. These are, you know, each of my cards, you know, through my writings, etc. You know, I've been researching commentaries and the synthesized interpretations of great scholarly studies of tarot for decades. So my interpretations are synthesized from what many have written, because that's the way meanings are developed. It's not just as individual, but it comes through a lot of qualified people. So for the well, I've written replenishment, healing waters of salvation, sublime aspirations, the silver cord attaching man to the center, rebirth, nourishment, refueling, medicinal rites, baptism, purification, resurrection, related to the lake, as with fishing, symbolic of drawing out and upwards the numinous contents of the deep, divination, mystic contemplation, reversed, sterility, the barren, resistance, addiction, disease, ghostly realms, wasteland, death by drowning, purgatory, or else reversed subjectively, catharsis, wishing well, meditative cleansing. In the spectrum of this particular archetype would be rebirth, purification, healing, and renewal. That's a pretty, complete summary of my thoughts on that card.
That's a potent symbol for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it kind of marks in Jungian psychology initiation through the second half of life, kind of that ego death or that renewal phase where Jung himself and many of us in our late 30s, for instance, go through these kind of deep changes in our underlying psyche, where our center of gravity is shifting from an ego base to a deeper self center, and kind of our whole sets of meaning and purpose in life are going through this spiritual crisis of sorts, and the well is replenishing the depths of ourselves, and we're going down in there. I think of that well card as signaling that phase of growth.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. To me, it definitely has this sort of the opportunity for rejuvenation and renewal. This sort of idea of it can be cleansing, or we can get lost in it. And and certainly in the lover's card, I'm still playing with the symbols. I'm not moving objects around on a sand table or whatever, but I am moving the objects around on the pages as I'm drawing them. And this sort of, depending on what you draw out from the other person will depend on which path the lovers take, which road that relationship goes down.
Well, so. in TNP, my deck, on what I call the new matrix, where I have these three rows of nine, in the path six, which is the lover's path of relationship, of course we have the classic, the lovers, and underneath that, the next phase up is the devil. We see that in the weight, et cetera, how the devil is that next stage up of the lovers. It's kind of the shadow side of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But where the modern tarot has stopped, this deck continues, and so going across the third row, the completion card that now ends that three-tiered process, that triadic process of lovers, the devil, is what I call the ring, and which is a symbol of wholeness. And it's one of these great archetypes like Lord of the Rings, and the ring has so much association, but it's really pointing to a new order of relationship that I think the world is moving towards in the future, and are having much more, these global participatory relationships where you can see in the picture it's no longer an I-thou based person-to-person relationship, but more the relatees are together in a circle or a ring of light, where they're now in a circularity, in a kind of a mandalic relationship with all the spheres, with all the galaxies and all the universes. So it's a completed stage of human relatedness, where ultimately relationships of the future, I think, are about shared participation in the whole. And that's what that symbol of the ring is about.
Well, and you can see that as happening. It makes a lot of sense for it to be the culmination of the lovers, or at least the ideal culmination of the lovers card as well, whether the union is just in a relationship or on all the levels of your life, you know? So, yeah, I really like that.
Well, the thing that I pretty much discovered in long contemplations on the psychology of the major arcana is, in my opinion, the most important, possibly the most important signature card that runs throughout the tarot, the major card, and what this deck certainly is an expression of, is, of all cards, the Hermit card. And it's the number 9, which brings all of this this tapestry together in perfect synchrony. And the meaning of the number 9 is most significant. And from a Jungian standpoint, we could simply say that the 9 is individuation or spiritual individuation, about finding one's natural spiritual path to wholeness. And that's really what I think the tarot is, what the map is about. There are many paths, not one path, but in this deck there are 9 very integrated, differentiated pathways. But it's all about that. It's really about the what I call the Hermit effect, and I think that's very, really, you could say it's a very Jungian idea, because individuation, of course, was probably Jung's central theory of this whole psychology.
Well, and the Hermit goes into the cave, into the dark, and finds the light, finds himself, right? Finds his individuation. So, yeah, right. Definitely. Makes sense. And, you know, the cave itself and the ring kind of resonate as similar symbols to me as well. You know, there are a number of decks that I think of where the cave has this very circular womb-like feeling. So, yeah. It's fascinating.
Exactly, right.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to share before we wrap this up? Is there anything else that you have on your mind around what we've been talking about? Or?
Great question. Let me just think for a moment, because I think we've covered a lot of really good things. Well, no, certainly, you know, if there's people out there who are reading this or whatever, listening to this, who would like to get more involved with me or my work, you know, I do have the, you know, it's our third year of our discussion group. We have about 190 people from all around the world that participate, called Tarot Psych. It's a Yahoo group online. It's free to join. There's a lot of interesting people from all around the world. We've been kind of not that busy in the last month or two due to my own crazy schedule. But often I have developed what I call cyber experiments, where I've developed a divination experiment meant for the internet in our group, where I tried to kind of like use group mind to draw cards and interpret cards from all around the world simultaneously to see if we can actually play and open up some kind of global communication network using tarot and tarot oracle work. It's been really a lot of fun, and there's been some really interesting things there. So that people can find at Tarot Psych. You can probably get it at my website, which is Moonlight Counseling, or Art Rosengarten at Moonlight Counseling. And that's about it. Well, it's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
I've really enjoyed this as well. I'm very, very happy with it, and it's been fascinating for me. So this has been Interviews About Change with Art Rosengarten. All of the details about how you can contact him and find him can be found in the body of the podcast post on my blog, thehermitslamp.com, and just click the tarot blog. There is also a little more content at the end of this interview where I discussed with Art some ideas about how I personally might pursue more information and getting more understanding about the Jungian approach and their ideas. It's not universally relevant as we talk about the Toronto area and things like that, but there is a bunch of interesting information in it nonetheless, so I decided to leave it at the tail end of this. If you've enjoyed this, please subscribe to my blog when you're there, either via your newsreader, or if you'd like to receive the audio content in iTunes, you can click the link from the blog and get there, or search Andrew McGregor or The Hermit's Lamp in iTunes and click on the podcast option, and you will find the content and be able to subscribe to it that way. Future interviews will include James Wells and Lon-Milo Duquette, as well as my wife interviewing me on the subject coming at the end of this process. So here's the extra content. Enjoy. I have one question for you on a personal note. Do you have any suggestions around receiving training with becoming more of a Jungian therapist or those kinds of things? It's an idea I've been exploring for a while, and I'm just curious if you have any. I'm up in Toronto, Canada, so I'm not going to be coming down and working in the States anywhere. But
you know, Daryl Sharp, he's in Toronto.
Okay, I don't.
Daryl Sharp, one of the preeminent Jungian analysts, who is the, owner editor of Inner City Books, just one of the premier publishers of Jungian books, and I believe they are in Toronto. But they know all the leading Jungian analysts in the world. That Daryl Sharp is who I would connect and ask that question to. He's in your own hometown. He's got, a wonderful Jungian lexicon online, which you can download. It must be like 150 pages. That is really brilliantly put together. As far as, now, are you a helping professional?
I'm a full-time tarot reader.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you talking about going into Jungian pursuit, going through like a training institute or in your own studies of Jungian, or which are you thinking?
I've been exploring the idea of going through a more formal training process certainly to learn the material, of course, but as a way of also becoming certified to do therapy, on that level as well. You know, I mean, anybody can kind of put it their shingle and say, "Hey, I do therapy," but especially in Canada, they're working on changing that. And I've been exploring it for kind of a couple of years now, but haven't. I had two kids over the last few years, so it's kind of got backburnered. But
here it's you have to understand that. Here you have to go through all kinds of levels of training and licenses and professional training first. You know, you have to be before you can call yourself a psychotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a long route. And once you've gotten there, you're not going to really get a lot of. Well, the one place that you would get great Jungian training going through school, even on undergraduate and graduate level. In the States now is Pacifica.
Okay.
You know that, Pacifica?
Yep.
It's in Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
It's a graduate, Jungian graduate training program, very popular in the West Coast these days. But as far as, developing with Jungian ideas, Jung is wonderful to read, and possibly getting involved with in a study group or something like that, but doing your own exploration. I know that the Jungian institutions can be very controlling and very rigid in terms of paying your dues, and they take forever to become a Jungian analyst.
Mm-hmm.
It takes like 8 years after your PhD or MD. So it's a huge training process, but that's not to say you can't study on your own.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And the way to do it is to read the collected works of C.J. G. Jung. He's once you get into reading him, he's a wonderful, wonderful writer. I would start with his autobiography, Memory Streams Reflections.
Okay. I will do that.
If you like reading him and you get where he's coming from, you will continue reading him, but you don't have to read it all. You just have to kind of be in the process of listening on his level.
Mm.
And then he's very rich.
Great.